program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Good afternoon to you. Welcome back to another edition of Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, heard every Saturday in the noon hour, sponsored by our friends at Moss and Barnett. Denny Law filling in for Steve Thompson. Steve will return to the station come tomorrow. We certainly wish he and his family well. Tom Schreier is back with us in the host chair. Nice to see you back here, Tom.
Great to be here again. Denny, thank you for that kind greeting, and we are excited here today to have with us John Boyle, a senior shareholder with Moss and Barnett. John is a lawyer who has litigated shareholder rights, corporate governance rights, and employment law for more than 20 years. And so we're reprising a program that we put together with John here last winter, Denny, on the rights of minority shareholders in closely held corporations. We had a lot of interest in that program from callers and also on a follow-up basis. So, John, we're happy to have you back.
Thank you.
I would also let our listeners know, Denny, that John started his career as a prosecutor for Golden Valley and the city of Plymouth as well at the start of his career. So he knows how to go after some bad guys.
That's why I'm moving over here.
John's also the proud parent, father of the starting quarterback of the St. John football team here for this year. John, that puts a lot of pressure on you, doesn't it?
It does. Usually I have to leave the stands at various points during the game because I just can't take it anymore.
I'm sure that's right. And of course, it helps with your roots being at St. John's as well. I know that you attended there as an undergrad and earned a degree in theology from the theology college there.
That's correct.
And so welcome. We're pleased again to have you here. And so maybe as we're starting, John, to talk about corporate rights, corporate law, we should just do a little bit of a big picture introduction for our topic. And let's just talk briefly about, you know, what generally is a corporation, because it really is a concept that's elusive, I think, for many people who don't work with it on a legal basis.
Essentially, a corporation is basically a legal person. The legal system sees it as though, although it's not a living, breathing person, it counts as a legal person. Corporations can enter into contracts. They can carry out business. They can be sued. And so it's typical that people with a business will want to incorporate, and one of the primary reasons is they can usually shield themselves from personal liability as opposed to operating as a sole proprietorship.
I know sometimes people think that's unfair, that the owners of a business just by making it into a corporation can avoid personal liability, but there's actually good reason for that law to exist, isn't there?
There is. It encourages business. It encourages people to pursue business opportunities, you know, hopefully responsibly, but without the threat that somehow they're going to be held personally liable. The other thing is, with respect to a corporation, you need shareholders, people to invest in the company, to participate in the company. And if there's a fear that they're going to be held liable potentially for the debts of the company personally, you're not going to find many people that want to contribute to a company and take on that responsibility.
Sure, you might be willing to risk, and they are by definition the capital they put into a company to buy their stock, for example, but wouldn't be willing to expose their entire net worth to the possibility that the corporation or its business will fail and that they'll have to in turn be wiped out personally.
That's absolutely correct. It invites investment into the company to a limited degree, but the shareholder who contributes the money, makes the contribution, isn't exposed, as you indicated, to somebody coming and trying to get their net worth.
Now, we're talking today about closely held companies. Those are sometimes called privately owned companies, and they're different from public stock companies. Isn't that true?
That's correct. If you get onto the NASDAQ or, you know, publicly traded stocks, those are there's a public market for them. There's certain rules and regulations that have to be followed in terms of how those securities are handled. When we talk about a closely held company, we're talking about a privately owned company with a limited number of shareholders. And in Minnesota, the statutory definition of a closely held company is a corporation with no more than 35 shareholders.
And so what that means is that if a company has 36 shareholders, then it's not closely held. But does it mean that it's publicly held then?
That's correct. You could still have a private company or what they call a closed company that's privately owned, but it wouldn't classify as a closely held company. And the important distinction there is, and we'll get into it later, is that there's statutory protections in Minnesota for shareholders in a closely held company. And unless, obviously, you meet that definition, you don't qualify for those particular protections.
Does that mean that the owners of stock in a company that has, say, 36 or more shareholders in Minnesota don't have any legal rights?
Well, they would. They'd have a different set of legal rights. And a lot of times shareholders, too, will protect themselves with various documents that they'll enter into in terms of shareholder agreements, their governance documents, et cetera. But yes, they would still have certain rights, just kind of a different type of right from what you get under the statutes as a minority shareholder in a closely held company.
Now, when I buy stock in a publicly traded company, as you say on the NASDAQ or other stock exchange, I'm expecting that I'll be able to sell it someday, and hopefully the price will have appreciated. Maybe I'll have some stock splits to boost that appreciation along with. But things are different, potentially at least, aren't they, with a company that it's not publicly traded?
Absolutely. And you hit the nail right on the head. With a publicly traded company, you can call your broker any day. You can sell or buy shares. With a closely held company, a privately held company, particularly a small one, there's going to be a very limited market for those shares. In fact, there may really be no practical market. And as a result, one of the reasons that a number of states, including Minnesota, have adopted laws to protect minority shareholders is based on the fact that there's limited marketability of the shares, limited liquidity. And what was happening in the past, we're going back two or three decades, was that the majority shareholder, or those who control the company, basically could hold a minority shareholder hostage and force them, if they wanted to get out of the company, to basically sell at a fire sale rate. And as a result, there's been this movement in the country, Minnesota included, to try to provide protections for minority shareholders to protect their interest in the company and allow them to not be or to set it up so that they're not taken advantage of.
I suppose we should clarify, of course, we're not talking about ethnic or racial minorities in this context, but rather people who own less than majority ownership in a company.
Exactly. Probably a good way to look at that is, let's say you've got a company that has two shareholders. One has 60% of the shares, one has 40%. The 40% shareholder is the minority because the majority shareholder with 60% basically can control the company. You could also have a similar situation. Let's use an example of three shareholders in a company. Each of them has a third of the stock. Two of those shareholders could team up together and basically hold a majority and take action against the minority shareholder, and they would hold voting power or control. And so as we'll get into it later, the laws were set up basically in those situations to say, okay, that's fine, but you can't improperly take advantage of a minority shareholder.
And so the law is set up to protect minority shareholders, and we'll talk some more about those rights here after our break.
Very good. We'll take a break right here. You're listening to Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett here on today's 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Let judgment be entered accordingly.
Did you know a civil judgment in Minnesota is valid for 10 years and can be renewed for another 10 years?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
And welcome back to this portion of Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We certainly welcome your related questions at 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Tom Schroyer is back in the host chair. The guest attorney with Tom is John Boyle. And where do we go from here?
Well, Denny, I do thank you for letting the folks know about the call-in number. We do encourage people to call. John is someone with great expertise, and I know worked on a number of the leading lawsuits here in Minnesota. And also, John, you worked on a groundbreaking lawsuit in Wisconsin for shareholder rights, as I recall.
Well, thank you. That's a nice compliment. We did work on a case that was very interesting, and perhaps this is kind of gives us a segue to kind of loop back into how these protections came about. But it used to be the law that basically minority shareholders had little or no rights. And the only way that you could overcome oppression by the majority shareholder or mistreatment by the majority shareholder was to pursue dissolution of the company. Courts disfavored dissolution and would rarely grant it except in the most extraordinary circumstances. So as a result, a minority shareholder was often stuck and just basically had to live with how they were being treated. Minnesota passed a statute back in the when was it? Back in 1981, they passed legislation that put into effect these protections for minority shareholders. And those that arose out of some case law that developed across the country beginning in 1970, where courts began to say, you know what, that's not fair, that's not right. We should really treat shareholders in a small company as though they are partners. And by being partners, they owe each other certain fiduciary duties of honesty, trust, transparency with the operations of the company. And so Minnesota passed a law in 1981 that provided those kind of protections, and we'll get into some of the details of that later. Wisconsin took a different approach. Well, Minnesota, when they passed the statute, it basically applies to any closely held company in the entire state. Wisconsin took a different approach, and they set up a statute similar, but the shareholders have to elect to follow that form of corporation. Otherwise, they're under the old system. And as it turned out, when we were involved in this case a few years ago, the majority of Wisconsin companies, and most of them are small family-owned companies, were under the old system, not the new system. And we had a situation with a shareholder who was claiming that he was oppressed, receiving unfair treatment from the majority, and this was a very successful company making a lot of money. And basically, the attorneys on the other side, who were very skilled attorneys, basically were telling us, too bad. There's nothing you can do about it. And so we brought an action. We ended up going to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals arguing, and in this particular case, because it was under the old statute, the only remedy was dissolution. And so the court at the trial court level said, I'm not going to dissolve this company. That's the only remedy you got. We went to the Court of Appeals and said, you know what? Dissolution also includes lesser types of remedies. And we convinced the Court of Appeals in Wisconsin in that particular case to say, you know what, the minority shareholder is entitled to a buyout. He's not just frozen or stuck in this company. And that's the kind of protection that every closely held company has in Minnesota and every minority shareholder has.
And the kinds of oppression we're talking about have a lot to do with how a company is governed and how decisions are made. And maybe let's talk first a little bit about that. A lot of people think that if I'm a shareholder, I have certain power, certain rights. And you know, the reality is often far different. Who makes decisions for a corporation, John?
Well, it's kind of a two- or threefold process. The shareholders have a right to vote directors who will serve on the board of directors who will ultimately kind of manage the company, make the decisions.
So they get to elect the directors.
They get to elect the directors. And usually their ability to elect directors is based on their percentage of shares or ownership interest in the company. As a result, for instance, if you're a minority shareholder, you'll have a vote. But a majority will probably have more control over determining who's going to be on that board of directors. Shareholders have a right to demand meetings. It's provided in the statute. Most companies have in their bylaws a requirement that there has to be an annual shareholder meeting every year. Otherwise, there are mechanisms under which a shareholder can ask for a general meeting, at which time they can present anything they want on the agenda or raise any issues. There's also some provisions where a shareholder can ask for a special meeting of the shareholders on a specific topic, but that topic has to be identified before the meeting occurs. So the shareholder will have some say in the shareholder meeting. Obviously, they've made an investment in the company. But the board of directors usually end up being the sort of governing body that makes decisions for the company. And the board of directors will elect officers who will carry out sort of the day-to-day business of the company. So you'll have a president, vice president, CFO, et cetera, who are given certain powers or duties or delegated certain responsibilities. And different small companies will put limits on that. They'll say, for instance, you know, the president can make decisions up to a certain money level or involving up to certain levels of commitment before it has to come back to the board of directors.
John, it sounds like shareholders' rights to control a company are actually rather, you might say, rather attenuated or diffuse.
Yes, shareholders' rights to control a company are diffused, particularly if you're the minority. The majority, if someone owns by themselves the majority shares, they pretty much can direct how the company is going to proceed. Our groups of shareholders can get together who will hold a majority and be able to kind of direct the actions of the company.
Well, we'll talk some more after the news break here about what amounts to shareholder oppression and what some of the remedies for that are, John.
All right, very good. We'll take this break for news and weather and be right back with more Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on 830 WCCO. Again, good afternoon to you. Welcome back to this portion of Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Host Tom Schroyer is back with us in studio. Good to see Tom back. And his guest, John Boyle, who also has been here before. Right, Tom?
Yes, we had John on last winter to talk about shareholder lawsuits and shareholder rights, and we had a lot of interest in that program. And, of course, we do invite our listeners to call in or text. John's happy to respond to questions. And has great expertise to bring to bear on this. And, John, I know we were talking during the break about addressing some of the examples of abuses of shareholders by their so-called partners in these smaller corporations that really can sometimes get quite out of hand.
Yes, Tom, that's unfortunately very true. And going back to the statute that Minnesota passed, as I talked about earlier in 1981, they put in this comprehensive statute that regulates a minority closely held companies and provides protections for minority shareholders. And they adopted principles that the shareholders should act in an honest, fair, and reasonable manner towards one another and respect each of their reasonable expectations of shareholders. And that's been held by courts to indicate that shareholders in a closely held company should act with the highest standards of integrity and good faith in their dealings with each other and that they cannot oppress fellow shareholders. Well, what we have happen, and what this law was designed to protect, is situations where the majority does oppress or freeze out the minority shareholder. And it can occur in situations such as these that I'll describe. For instance, suddenly financial information isn't being shared with the minority shareholder, even though they have a right to understand the finances and know what the business activities of the company are. I've seen games played where people don't receive proper notice of meetings or inadequate notice or late notice, which the rules protect against or the law protects against. A classic example is how money is distributed within the company. The majority may have a way of controlling things that they can manipulate how distributions are paid so that they're unfairly getting a greater amount of distributions pro rata based on the shares than the minority shareholder. And there are cases of oppression where the majority basically tries to squeeze out the minority by doing things like that, not giving them their distributions, taking other actions which kind of close them out or shut them out of the active operation of the company with the intent that the minority shareholder will become frustrated and eventually say, you know what, I give up. I'll sell you my shares. I know I'm not going to get a good price, but give me something. And as a result, this Minnesota statute also provides that shareholders in a who hold a minority position are entitled to fair value for their shares if there's a dispute and they want to get out of their ownership of stock in the company. And fair value means essentially the going concern price of the company or value of the company, and you take that particular shareholder's ownership interest. So if you value the company at, say, $10 million, the minority shareholder holds 30%, their share of that going concern value would be $3 million. There's a tendency in valuing companies that usually if you ask an appraiser, come value my company, they're going to usually apply a marketability discount and a minority discount, which means they're going to say, look, the company is not readily very sellable. You're only going to be able to sell a minority interest where we won't be able to exercise much control. Therefore, you should discount that price. So, for instance, someone who has no connection with a company that buys in, somebody wants to sell them their shares, they very well may want to apply such discounts, saying, look, you know, the company may be worth $10 million. Your share is $3 million. But I can't control the company. I have a limited market. Therefore, we're going to apply some discounts. I'm only going to pay you a couple million dollars. So that happens. But the law about fair value says, no, you get the going concern value, your percentage. And the courts basically have said in those situations, we're not going to apply those kind of discounts absent some very unusual circumstances.
So, John, it sounds to me like the law provides a premium value to be paid for stock if the owner of less than control stock has been oppressed in violation of their legal rights.
Well, I wouldn't call it a premium, but I would call it fair value. And I think it's designed that as a going concern company, it has a value. The minority shareholder should be entitled to his fair share of that value and not discounted or the number pushed down because he doesn't have anybody to sell it to, or he doesn't have any control in the company.
Well, sure, but by the same token, if there hasn't been this sort of misconduct that we've been talking about, they are going to be stuck with selling their stock for what's called fair market value, which I think you'd have to agree includes or usually includes these very kinds of discounts that you've been talking about, namely a discount because my stock doesn't bring with it voting control or it's not liquid because I can't sell it anywhere.
That's a very good point, and it kind of leads into an area I want to be sure we cover today, which is things that minority shareholders can do to sort of protect their interests. And you're right. I mean, if a shareholder wants to liquidate their shares, they'll look to the other shareholders to buy them out. If they don't want to buy them out, they'll sell to an outside shareholder, and most likely they're going to be paying market value. There'll be discounts applied. Shareholders can protect themselves by entering into a shareholder agreement of some kind.
Some kind of a shareholder control agreement?
It can be a control agreement. It could be an agreement that regulates how their shares will be dealt with or sold if they become disabled, die, or no longer are involved with the company. And a lot of times those shareholder agreements will include an agreed-upon mechanism up front for exactly how a person's shares are going to be valued. There's lots of different ways they can do it. I've seen examples where they use a book value. Certain types of companies may use a multiplier times net profits, like they'll go two or three times last year's net profits. I've seen many situations where the parties agree that if a shareholder's leaving, wants to tender his shares back, or is required to under the agreement, that the parties will select a sort of third-party appraiser or evaluator, and everybody agrees that they will live with his or her decision about the value of the company and therefore that shareholder's interest.
Now, if there is such an agreement in place and the parties later have a falling out, is the buyout price for the victim of this oppression based on this statute, which calls for fair value like you've been talking about, or does their agreement trump that?
In most cases, the agreement trumps, which is why a shareholder wants to be very careful about the documents that they enter into. I think I'm not trying here to promote full employment for attorneys, but I think anyone who's going to sign a document that has some significant legal ramifications should consult with an attorney. And in this case, I think it would be good if one is going to enter into a shareholder agreement to make sure their interests are being protected. And I can't tell you, Tom, how many times, and I know this is applied to you, where a 15-minute phone call to me would have saved someone $50,000 or $100,000 because they make a decision that's just it made sense to them, but it wasn't the appropriate decision in terms of legal protection or a decision, and it ends up in a very uncomfortable litigation.
Well, what I see too, John, is that at the start of the relationship, it's akin to a new marriage. Everybody's happy and lovey-dovey, and they don't anticipate, you know, what might happen down the road. And so really, they don't do a good job of entering into these agreements for two reasons. First of all, they tend not to have them because they think that everything's going to work out just fine like it starts out. And second, they tend to be reliant upon a single lawyer to prepare the entire agreement for everybody and not, don't get their own attorney. So they end up not necessarily having their own distinct rights protected.
That's correct, Tom. And what will happen a lot of times is the company attorney will prepare these documents. And the company attorney, if they're careful, they're going to tell the shareholders, look, I don't represent any of your interests. I'm just simply the scrivener here. I'm the person just putting together the document. You guys have to agree on the terms. I'll incorporate it. I advise you to get independent counsel to review. There's not a particular design to have something evil in the document, but it may turn out there's a provision that's unsatisfactory or prejudicial to someone who might be in a minority shareholder position that they probably should not consent to, but they bypass it. They don't realize that. And I think you made an excellent point too, that so often, and you see this particularly with family businesses and closely held businesses where friends or associates put together a business, there's this degree of trust up front. There's the sky is all blue. We're going to have a wonderful relationship, and it ends up down the road somewhere. There's a major disagreement, a major falling out that becomes irreconcilable, and you can't believe how ugly these situations can get. I mean, I refer to them as corporate divorces. I mean, people that were the best of friends and great business associates 1 year, 5 years later, absolutely resent each other, won't talk to each other, and believe the other person is trying to take advantage of them.
Well, and sadly, sometimes these things afflict families as well, which when they have a shared ownership of a business or some kind of a property interest, and those can be the saddest of all of these kinds of cases. I know I worked on one in a state out in the western part of the United States where a brother and a sister went at each other for 13 years of litigation, and it was really quite embittered and unbelievably expensive as well as extraordinarily long.
That's absolutely true. And it's sad because I've seen situations where families are torn apart, and father won't speak to son anymore. Brothers are at odds with one another, won't speak to each other. Really sad. And again, they all started with like the best of plans, the best of motives, and then something goes wrong. Someone becomes resentful because I'm working more than my brother is. Therefore, I should be entitled to more of a percentage in the company than my brother. You know, he takes vacations all the time. I got to work every weekend. It's not fair.
What should have been done, especially in the family scenario? What should those people, like you suggested, Tom, get their individual attorney? Or what could have prevented this family feud when it comes to business like this?
Well, I think, some of it is just going to happen. There's going to be bumps along the way, and you have to have ways to work it out. But I think what would help is upfront, making sure your governance documents, how your corporation is set up, how it's going to be run is properly set up, that you're following proper formalities, you're actually having shareholder meetings, you're actually having board of directors meetings, that you enter into a shareholder agreement that anticipates things that could happen in the future, such as disability, where you automatically know what's going to happen with the stock, you know how it's going to be valued. And under the statute, there's a presumption that evaluation mechanism you have in a shareholder agreement is going to be what's going to be applied, unless for some reason the court should find that the application of it is so unreasonable that it wouldn't be fair.
All right. We'll take a bit of a break here and be right back. Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. We'll be right back with more here on 830-WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Moss and Barnett, excellence in the community. Did you know every year Moss and Barnett awards the Paul Van Valkenburg Award for Distinguished Community Service to one of its employees? Past winners include Tom Keller, Chuck Parsons, Connie Schofield, Adrian Summerfield, Kevin Bush, and Cheryl Riggs.
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Minnesota's 830.
And we welcome you back to this portion of Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett, heard every Saturday in the noon hour here on 830 WCCO. And I guess, Tom, I could add, too, that if folks want more information, may I mention the website?
Oh, absolutely.
Moss-Barnett.com. We'll do that before you and John leave us today, too. What's next?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about how people can plan ahead for some of the issues that tend to erupt or have a tendency to erupt over the years. And one of them, John, is you know, how to deal with the expectation of whether or not people are going to have jobs or employment with the company that they're founding and co-owning.
Often in a startup company, the shareholders, they're business partners, they've plan this whole thing. They're ready to get it going. They put some money into it, set up the corporation. They each have stock. They also may very well have a reasonable expectation of continued employment, that as long as that company is going, they're going to have a job, because that's part of the way they take the value out of the company or get value out of their investment. And as many of you out there know who perhaps have small businesses or started small businesses, you put a lot of sweat equity in the front to make something become profitable down the road. And so in many cases, really the only benefits that the shareholder may be getting are the salary he's getting, are health benefits, et cetera, for his family. And there's not enough money after that to pay really dividends. With that expectation, if the shareholders come into that with that expectation, there's actually some case law in Minnesota which basically says that should be honored. Now, there are some exceptions, but if the parties come in with a reasonable, understood expectation among themselves that they were each going to have continued employment, and then, for instance, let's say three brothers or three sisters, let's use three sisters, they have a company together, all equal shareholders, they have a falling out, two sisters fire the other sister. There's actually some case law in Minnesota that would require a reinstatement of that employment or payment of lost wages or payment of some value for the lost opportunity there by her being fired when she, like her sisters, had the expectation that she would have continued employment.
Well, it can also be the occasion for a judge to order a buyout of the aggrieved sister, in this case, is stock at this premium fair value price.
Exactly. And what happens is that because the parties have such irreconcilable differences, they really can't sit in the same room together. They can't get along. If the minority shareholder who's been fired and frozen out, she brings a lawsuit seeking equitable remedies under the statute, there's a good chance that she will be awarded her fair share of the company, fair value, and most likely she'll be paid some value for the loss of her expectation of continuing employment. And I've seen situations where, you know, for instance, someone gets fired by their fellow shareholders at 55. There's a reasonable expectation that they would have been employed till 65. There'll be some value put for what that lost amount of wages is, as well as any back pay or lost wages that they suffered. There's one caution here, and I want to be sure to alert people to this. Even though there can be that expectation, reasonable expectation of continued employment, that courts very well may honor if it's pretty clear and you can establish the facts. If the employee, however, enters into an at-will employment contract, they basically negated that expectation.
And an at-will employment agreement is one that says that the employer can fire the employee at any time for no reason, a good reason, or
right.
a bad reason.
Right. And most of us employed out there have at-will employment contracts. I mean, the owner, whoever runs the company, could basically get up and fire us someday just because they're in a bad mood, as long as they don't fire us for an illegal reason. And what happens often is that shareholders will come into the company with expectations of continuing employment. Later on, they decide, you know, we should really formalize our documents more and line some things up. So they'll enter into new shareholder agreements. They might pass new bylaws. And then they'll have all the shareholders sign employment agreements. And those employment agreements may have in there that they now have become an at-will employee. They could be fired for any reason. Or there might even be a provision that they can be fired for good cause and there's certain reasons set forth. And a shareholder may unwittingly sign something like that without having talked to counsel, and as a result, waive their reasonable expectation of continuing employment. And the courts have basically said that. If you sign an at-will employment contract, that obviously means you didn't plan to have employment there forever.
And speaking of not working someplace forever and possibly even someday retiring, I imagine it would also be wise to include in an upfront agreement something about a transition from being involved with the company and leaving the company, and at the same time having the right to sell your stock.
Right. Different companies will do different things, but there's all kinds of options out there. For instance, there can be an arrangement where if someone hits a certain age, they'll be bought out over a period of time, and there's a mechanism of how much they'll be paid, et cetera. I think succession planning is very important because you see dad started the company, has two daughters. He's getting ready to retire, decides that he wants to turn over basically control of the company to one daughter. The other one becomes very offended, creates all kinds of problems. You need to think of that down the road, how those things can manifest and the impact that they can have. And just as a final comment, I would say, as a practical piece of advice, when you get into a corporation, a small company, a closely held company, hope for the best, but plan for the worst.
All right. Thanks, John.
Sounds like good advice in life as well. Tom, good to see you again. See you next week.
Yes, we'll be at the State Fair with you, Denny. Thank you.
We'll see you there. And right next to Sweet Martha's. And John, good to see you. Good to meet you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for showing up. Stay tuned next. Eric Nelson's in studio here on 830 WCCO. See you in the morning.